highly recommend the Sage lunch. I crashed the last one, and I fully intend to crash this one. Delicious. And I didn't even take anything, which is a big problem at a potluck. But well, hi, guys. Good to see you again. All right, so I'm going to open up to Matthew chapter 8. Okay, so we are week number 2 of our Lent series, and we are calling the series Encounters, and we are looking at various gospel encounters. Basically, somebody has an encounter with Jesus, and we want to know about it. And the whole idea here in this season of Lent, especially as we examine these encounters, is we're really just wanting to create some space. And our prayer is, and our desire is, that we might have a few encounters of our own. And so today we're going to be in Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 5. So last week I talked about this idea of expectations, and I want us to continue with that idea in our head as we go into, if we think about any relationship we have in our life, really any encounter we have in our life, there's always a level of expectation connected to it. And so today, keep that in your mind as we are exploring this narrative of Jesus and a guy whose name we never know. So we will just call him the centurion. I think in the Spanish translations, he's like capitán, so maybe that's more fun for us. But very different from last week's encounter, which, as I mentioned, was really close friends. It happened in the context of deep, like, trusting, intimate relationships among friends, community, connection. In this case, this is one of these encounters that's kind of out of the blue. To our knowledge, these two had never met before, and they, to our knowledge, never meet again. And so this was just an encounter that happened, a one-time thing. And so in a lot of ways, it's different from last week, but that's part of the idea, is that encounters with Jesus happen anytime, anywhere, with anyone, in any place. And so I think that there is a lot for us here today. And so let's pray, and then let's jump into Matthew 8, starting in verse 5. So Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we recognize that you are here among us. We're aware of your presence, and we don't take that lightly. And so I ask that as we open your word today, that you would stay near to us. Would you give us grace to be present? Give us eyes to see, ears to hear. Give us hearts that are open to anything that you want to do with us today. We say yes, we say that we are ready. Amen. All right. Matthew 8, starting in 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. And he said to those following him, truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. So this is pretty cool. In many ways, it doesn't necessarily follow some of the patterns that we see, even in chapter 8 of Matthew. But in other ways, I see the simplicity and authenticity to it that I think really bless the heart of God. So let's talk about the centurion. We got to set up our cast of characters. This was a Roman officer. He was a military man. He was therefore educated, probably more than the average person. He had a level of influence. He was accomplished in his field. He was not an Israelite. He was not Jewish. He did not have a background in faith. So in many ways, he was not in the inside circle. He was not on the core team, if you will. And although this was a powerful man, he had some power in his world, in his little space where he existed. But there was something that he was unable to do, even with his power, and that was to heal this sick person who was under his roof. And so he came to someone who he thought could heal him. And so that in and of itself tells me that he apparently at least knew Jesus by reputation. He had an idea that this man was a healer, that this man was important, and so he took the chance and he came to him to do that which he himself could not do. And so in some ways, this encounter, it was arranged. It was sought out. This man sought out Jesus. So they didn't just run into each other. We'll see some encounters like that later in the series. But he sought him out. He came to find him. And so you'll notice from the beginning that the centurion, he starts out by stating his situation. He very simply says, "Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." Full stop. He states his situation. He doesn't immediately go into his ask, which is interesting, but he states his situation, and then he allows Jesus to respond. And Jesus actually responds with an offer based on an assumption. "Oh, okay, so your servant is at home paralyzed. Would you like me to come and heal him?" It's always interesting to see Jesus' response to people because it's not a cookie-cutter response because the encounters are not cookie-cutter, which is fun. So in this case, the guy says, "Hey, I have a servant at home. They're paralyzed." Jesus says, "Would you like me to come?" I assume that that felt like the natural next step. This is what people wanted. And, you know, in the passage right before this, he touched a leper. In the passage right after that, he's going to go to Peter's house and touch his mother-in-law and heal her. And so, you know, physical touch, that was part of it, right? But this is where the story gets a little bit fun. The centurion responds by saying that Jesus doesn't even have to come to his house. Just say the word. All you got to do is say the word. You don't even need to come over. And then the centurion goes into this little dialogue, right, about, "For I myself am a man under authority. I have soldiers under me," etc., etc. I love this, that the centurion takes what he knows of Jesus, which isn't nearly as much as some other people would know. He obviously respects him. He knows he's a healer. And so he goes to them. He states his case. Jesus says, "Okay, well, do you want me to go lay hands on him, holy hands?" And the centurion says, no, just say the word because here's how I understand you." And then he goes into this kind of military explanation. "Because I have people under me, so I'm a man of authority, so I kind of get you because you're a man of authority. And all I have to do is say the word. And so isn't that how you work?" I kind of love it that this man connected with Jesus in a way that he knew how. Using his own language, his own world, and it was enough. It was enough. In fact, it was actually more than enough, because you'll notice here that it says that Jesus was amazed. I don't know about you, but I actually have a very difficult time imagining Jesus being surprised by anything. I'm like, doesn't he like go around and be like, "This person's about to walk up to me. They're about to say hi. They're about to do," you know, like he's, what is that, omniscience? But like we said last week, fully God, fully human. He has the whole breadth of emotions and expressions as any human would. And so in this instance, it says Jesus was amazed. There's only one other time in the Gospels when it says that Jesus, it uses the same language, and that is in Mark 6, and he was amazed at their lack of faith. And that was, I believe, the Jewish leaders, group of insiders. Jesus was amazed. And if I can go into my imagination a little, which I can because I have the mic, I think he was delighted. I think he was really delighted. Like, I'm imagining, do you ever think about, like, the tone that Jesus used or the look on his face? I think he was like, did you see that guy? Look at this faith. This is amazing. Like, I think he was, like, tickled, if I may say. Such a silly word. How are you translating that up there? I don't know. Look at this faith. This is admirable. This is the kind of faith that I'm looking for. And Jesus had been traveling and teaching and interacting with a lot of people. We're coming off the Sermon on the Mount, you know, like he has been out there mixing and mingling. And this guy amazed him? Wow. And keep in mind, this man did not have the right background. He wasn't part of the chosen people. He more than likely didn't know the scriptures. He didn't know the traditions. Yet what he knew of Jesus was enough. And Jesus decided to make an example of him. Okay, I would like to just say this. There is a right way and a wrong way to make an example of someone. My fourth grade teacher really liked to make examples of people. Her name was Mrs. Hammond. If you're out there, I don't think she's... Even at that time, she was like knocking on the door of retirement. She was old school. She was like just watching the clock, you know. And I will tell you two different times that she made examples of people. One time was this boy named Norman. If he's out there, I hope he's in therapy right now. But Norman had some behavior challenges. And at this particular school, at this particular time, there was still corporal punishment happening, which means you got paddled at school. Did y'all grow up in schools like that? I don't think that happens anymore, right? But this was the early 90s, and it was still, at least in like small town Oklahoma, they were paddling children. And so Norman had a close relationship with the paddle, sadly, and... And so I remember one day, Mrs. Hammond was like threatening the class, like, y'all better be quiet or whatever. People were acting crazy, and she threatened spanking, and she said, and I sure can swing a paddle, can't I, Norman? And I just remember Norman going like this. Poor Norman. And then the other thing I remember, which this is a true story, is it'll tell you a lot about me, but at some point, also, people were out of control or whatever, and she just said, why can't you guys be more like Megan? Come on. Because I was that kid. I followed the rules and was very agreeable, and she really liked me, which was, like, nice, but also, like, Mrs. Hammond really liked me, but she didn't like anybody else, and anyway, that was my educational background. But Jesus was not making an example out of the centurion in order to either bring shame or to like puff him up, right? Jesus was very good at taking advantage of any moment was a learning moment. We saw that in last week's message, and we see it again here in a different way. And he said, guys, look, this is the example. Not that you have to all be a Roman centurion, but the posture of this man's heart... This is what we're after. This is the money thing. Like this almost childlike belief that he had. He was open to Jesus, and Jesus was open to him. And in all of this, Jesus is pointing people not to the man himself, not be more like Megan, but he was pointing people to the kingdom. He's giving us real life examples. This is what it looks like to follow me. This is what I'm actually after. This is what delights me. This is what brings joy to my heart. I notice a couple of specific things about this centurion interaction. And one is that in some way he had just absolute confidence. He just assumed that Jesus could do it. And in a way, like his naivety, I cannot say that word. I had to look it up on the internet, how to spell it, because it's got those two I's. He was a bit naive, but that kind of worked in his favor. And not that we're all supposed to be like silly and we don't know things, but like he just kind of had confidence that this healer could help him. And that actually was helpful to him. He wasn't coming in with a ton of baggage or a bunch of ulterior motives. He had a problem. He couldn't fix his own problem. He trusted that the healer could, and so he came. I think sometimes the longer that we are around faith, the less simple our faith becomes. We get things a little complicated sometimes, and I don't know that it always has to be. Life is complicated. I don't know that Jesus has to be so complicated. I notice about this man that there was a humility to his posture. He was confident, but not arrogant. He was right-sized. You know, Josh likes to talk about that, right-sizing ourselves. He had this right-sized vision of himself and Jesus. I'm a man, you know, who has many people under authority, but in this context, he knew that he was under Jesus' authority. And so even with a lot of power in the world, he knew who he was before Jesus. Even this Jesus who, again, he didn't know a lot about. When he says to Jesus, that you know, he says this, you're not, what does he say? Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof. And it's not I don't see that as a statement of flattery. I see that as deference, submission, honor. I don't even deserve to have you come to my house, but you can just say the word. And I also see some imagination in here. I see some creativity to his request. I see him embracing a less limited, a less constricted view of Jesus. You don't have to come touch him, just say it. That is kind of a creative request. There was a little bit of imagination to it. I just kept thinking, even as I was prepping this, like, you know, Jesus tells us to become like a child. In many ways, I feel like this is an interesting example of that. And from an educated, you know, leader type person, becoming like a child doesn't mean that we become like goofy or not educated or not. But there's a confidence in Jesus. There's a submission to him. There's imagination. Kids can be like oddly confident. Have you ever like asked a 4-year-old to tell you about dinosaurs? They know exactly what they'll just tell you. There's a confidence here. There's an imagination here. It tells me that there's not necessarily a right way to come to Jesus. I think the right way is just to come. And oftentimes we are our own worst enemies when it comes to things like this. You know, the faith that blesses the heart of God, I think the faith that brings amazement and delight to Jesus, it's not based on having superior knowledge or having like very complex theological understanding or being from the right culture, the right background, using certain words, certain formulas, having everything figured out, having ourselves put together. But the faith that blesses the heart of God is humble and is believing. And it doesn't mean that we don't study and we don't seek knowledge and we don't want to have good theology and all these things. But again, I think oftentimes we put a lot of barriers in front of us getting to Jesus that Jesus hasn't actually put there. We get stuck in our own selves. We make it very complex. And this guy didn't know enough to make it complex. He just came. I think sometimes we have a lot of knowledge, like so much knowledge sometimes that we are almost paralyzed in putting to action anything that we know. Like we actually know a lot of things about God, many of us, maybe not everyone. But how can we actually get out of our own way and put some of that knowledge to action? It's an interesting little situation, the centurion and Jesus. And if we think about it in terms of like the expectations of the encounter, I see two different interesting things. First of all, I see the centurion who came and the expectation was to find some help for this servant who was paralyzed at home. He came for healing and what he received was the kingdom. And Jesus I don't think he was expecting to find such faith that day. He was pleasantly surprised by what he found. It does tell us that the servant was healed in the very same hour, at the same moment that all this was happening. This person at home, whose story we know little about, whose situation we don't fully even understand other than they were suffering, in that moment, they were healed. And in many ways, the health of that servant, the healing of that servant, was a sign of the kingdom coming. It was a sign of what Jesus is trying to talk about here. A sign of the significant thing that is happening, that was happening, that is happening on the earth in the person and the work of Jesus. We talk about both proclaiming and demonstrating the kingdom. In this little narrative, we have both. We have a proclamation of the kingdom, and we also have a demonstration in the healing of this servant, which is actually pretty exciting. I think everybody got more than they came for here, which is so often the case with encountering Jesus, right? We're only on week two, but spoiler alert, oftentimes we get a lot more than we came for. We have a very narrow idea of what we need or what we want or how this is going to go, and Jesus just like throws open the doors. Like, here you go, kid. I mean, didn't he say that? Hasn't he given us the kingdom, given us all things? If we can maybe get out of our own way enough to get to him, he is open to us. Are we open to him? And so the kingdom has come and the kingdom is coming among us. We can be confident in Jesus. We can come humbly. We can imagine the possibilities. We can be creative and imaginative. And we get to watch for how he moves. We get to watch for what he does next. And we get to be surprised and maybe even bring some surprise and delight to the heart of God. I think that's an exciting thing to consider, the fact that God's heart could be delighted in how I come, in our interaction, in our encounter. So today is Communion Sunday. I got pockets. There's boxes around, so some of you may have not grabbed your elements on the way in. We have a couple different kinds because, you know, they were back ordered. So you might get this one and you might get the other one, but it's all the same. It's all the same, bad tasting cracker and juice. But it's a sign of much more. Good work, folks. So I have a real strong sense today of just an invitation to the table. So Jesus says this in our passage. He says, "Truly, I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." He's like, guys, you might be surprised who comes to the table. In this chapter 8 of Matthew alone, got a person with leprosy. That shouldn't have happened. Unclean. We have our centurion who's Gentile. That's not supposed to happen. And then in the next verse, Peter's mother-in-law. Oh, mother-in-laws. No, just kidding. but, you know, especially in this ancient culture, a woman didn't have much of a place at the table other than to, like, serve the table, make the food, clean it up. But Jesus is saying, the table is open. And that should be good news. That those who thought they were on the inside and thought that everyone else was on the outside, he's like, hey, listen, I'm not looking at status. I'm not looking at, are you this or are you that? Are you this or are you that? Or, you know, do you fit this? He's looking at our hearts, at the posture of our hearts. Are we coming open to him? Are we saying yes to him? If that is our posture, he wants to say yes to us. It's not about fitting the right criteria, which to me is a great comfort. And so I wanted to take a little time today as we move toward a communion moment is to really think about this table that he lays before us. You know, he talked about the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. You know, that's where this whole thing is headed, to that new creation when heaven comes to earth and a new creation is established and everything wrong will be made right. And when all of this culminates and the Bible gives these really cool images of the feast, we're going to have an amazing meal. If you think about the best meal you've ever had, it's nothing compared to this feast, this table, where we are all invited to come and sit and be with one another and to be with the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit in the new creation, how it's supposed to be. So I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up, and we're going to, I want us just to spend a moment. Considering. Considering the invitation to the table, to this place that he is preparing for us, not some like, you know, it's all like kind of foggy and I'm floating on a cloud and I'm playing a harp and, but Jesus is actually inviting us to a feast, and he is inviting all to a feast who will say yes. And so if you would, with me, if you're comfortable closing your eyes, and I'm going to invite you to stretch a little, not physically, like maybe mentally, just to stretch a little. Maybe this might be kind of weird for you, but it's all right. I'm going to read a little from Isaiah chapter 25, and I want you to, in the best way you can, imagine this great feast. Imagine what you see there. How does it smell? How does it feel? Who's around the table? Isaiah 25, I'm going to start in verse 6. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all people.